Hello, this is Monica Reed and I'm Georgina Godwin. Well, in these coronavirus times, it's really lovely to turn away from disease and look towards something that's usually positive, and that's love. Today, I'm speaking to Laura Mooker. After initially embarking on a career in international law, she was involved in an accident, and that was the catalyst for a career change. Well, she's now an award-winning poet, a writer, and a speaker. Her latest book, We Need to Talk About Love, is an in-depth analysis of how we think, feel, and behave when it comes to that emotion. Laura, welcome to Monocle Reads. Now, obviously, I need to know about this great big catalyst in your career. Tell us what happened.
I've done quite a lot of travel and I've done quite a lot of dangerous things in those travels. And there was something ironic about the fact that I was walking across the road, genuinely 5 minutes from my home, when a taxi sped around the corner and smacked me on my knees and I went flying back. And I still have that moment, like, I can still see that moment of impact on my knees and thinking, okay, this is not how I thought today was going to go. And I went flying back and people that saw the event and called the ambulance were like, it was horrific, it was very surreal and we were incredibly worried about you. I went flying back and then the passenger got out of the car and said, do you mind if I keep going because I'm late for a flight? And thankfully, all the people... all the witnesses said, no, you can't leave. You're a witness. You can't go anywhere. And then when the ambulance came, they said, actually, you know, we've seen quite a lot of horrific things. Someone committed suicide recently and someone ran to help, jumped out of a window. Someone ran over to help them. But actually, they weren't running over to help. They were running over to steal their wallets. So, you know, I was very lucky to have the witnesses that I did have. They were offering me mineral water and being very kind. But it was very interesting for me because... up until that point, I had been very, very driven and my identity had been largely defined by my achievements and my ability to do and my ability to be positive. And I could no longer do, I was left essentially bedbound for a couple of years and had cardiac arrest and all these horrible things. And all my friends were out having a brilliant time because, you know, not many people are stuck in bed when they're 29. And I couldn't... do something very simple like go to a supermarket, there was a 2 minute walk, or go to the post office, or really do anything. And it really forced me to look at what I valued in life and what I wanted to do with whatever of life I had left. And it engendered a really phenomenal amount of gratitude for everything. And it sticks with me to this day. Like the postman would come over and that would be, you know, the highlight of my day. I'm like, hello, postman. And I think the thing that kept me sane throughout all of that was, other than the really amazing people in my life, who I had a tendency to push away but have kind of processed that, was writing, whether that's poetry for children or researching love and listening back to interviews I had done many years before with people around the world. So when I was in hospital, when I was stuck in bed, which was pretty much most of the time, I could pretend I was, you know, in a really random location around the world speaking to wonderful people about love. So it was my saviour, I think.
Let's have a look at the book in some detail, because you spoke to hundreds of strangers from all across the age range, from 8 years old to 95. You went to over 40 countries and you asked for their personal stories, their feelings and their insights on love. So a number of really important questions come up. Firstly, how does your upbringing influence your relationships?
I think it's an enormous question. And to do justice to it, we'd probably need a couple of hours or maybe days. But I can give you snippets that will give you an insight into just how profoundly important our upbringing is on our later relationships. I also had a vested interest in this because I was brought up by my mum and grandparents, and my grandfather, who I called Dad, died when I was 11. And I knew that that had impacted me. I just did not understand how. And in the process of writing this and researching it, I came to understand. So one of the easiest ways into exploring your upbringing is to look at a theory called attachment theory, which is one of the most researched areas in psychology and a complete game changer when it comes to love, but also something that's incredibly complex because it's the most researched area and lots of different academics have different terms and different ways of measuring it, and they're not always measuring the same thing. And so it's a very sticky subject, I think, to get right. The basic premise is that when we're growing up, we learn from the people that are bringing us up, whether that's our parent, grandparent, guardian. Older siblings can also play a role, important teachers. And if you feel that you are loved, that you have a relative amount of consistency and sensitivity growing up, then you will come to believe that relationships are a safe place to be, that you have control over your environment, and that you are worthy of love. And you will then, in all likelihood, develop what is called a secure attachment pattern. And that's true of 58% of the population, based on a review of studies across countries involving more than 10,500 people.
Wow. Do you think that we all have a the one? I mean, does love at first sight exist? And is it that one person? There could be no other. Should you just know?
Well, I think that comes back to attachment theory, because if you have another of the types, which is avoidant attachment, then you're likely to have doubts about everyone that you date, because you have a tendency to subconsciously want to avoid commitment. And so it doesn't really matter who you meet, you'll find problems. And Alexandru, who I interviewed, who was from Romania, put it brilliantly. And he said, because he said he thought he had an avoidant attachment pattern, he said, the way that I related to people was broken, so I could have met Beyonce and found faults. So to make general statements about the whole population, like if you have doubts, then it's not right, is to overlook the individual differences, but also I think to completely reduce love to black and whites, and it's not about that. There's so many grays. And I don't think there's a one, which is frustrating, because in a US study of 20 to 29 year old single people, 88% of people thought there was a soulmate just waiting for them out there. But I think that overlooks the role that we play in relationships, and it almost gives it, I think it discourages personal responsibility for the way that we behave.
What about love at first sight?
Well, I feel like I'm a bit controversial in my views on this. I interviewed people who did fall in love at first sight, and who said they fell in love at first sight and happened to stay with that person and felt that they'd got it right. But for every person that got it right, I interviewed at least as many, but if not more, who got it very, very, very wrong. And this guy that I met in Antarctica, who had sold all his belongings to travel the world with a tiny bag, put it brilliantly. And he said, essentially, in that early stage, you're high on drugs. You wouldn't make big decisions on heroin, would you? So why would you do it in that early stage of love? And just because the people that got it right turned out to have been right later on, it doesn't mean that they weren't over-optimistic to begin with. And I interviewed a philosopher called Simon Blackburn about this, and he has a text on lust. And we talked about the idea of time, and if love requires time, then love at first sight by definition can't exist, because that time, the requisite time to develop intimacy and real knowledge of each other, hasn't passed.
Mm. So it's lust, it's a chemical thing that happens, you see somebody and find them attractive.
Yes, but I think there's also all sorts of very complex subconscious things going on. You know, they might remind you of someone who you loved deeply growing up, for example. You know, you might be projecting all sorts of, you know, you might be projecting in the way that every human projects at the outset, but there's also going to be projection that is very particular to you, whatever it is that you specifically want or that you've cut off from yourself that you would like to find in someone else. You know, I think there's a lot of, there's an element which is nice, neat and clear and neuroscientific, lust, drugs, you know, and then there's a kind of murky, subconscious, swirly pile of factors.
Mm. I mean, I want to ask you what one should look for in a partner, but I guess it's different for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is different for everyone. And also, I would keep in mind that the evidence is very robust on this, that what we think we want is often has very little to do with what we actually go for. And that's backed up by online dating and speed dating studies where people have been followed over time, and a lot of online dating apps basically ignore what people say because they know that there's such a disparity between the two things. But I also think it's interesting to think about two things. One is what people around the world have said that they look for. And in a study called the International Mate Selection Project, 10,047 people across 37 countries rated kindness and understanding as the most important thing in a partner. And I do think that's important for everyone. I mean, I really think of, there aren't many things in life that I'm prepared to be, you know, pretty global about. I think kindness is pretty important for everyone. And then the other thing that I think is key is to remember some brilliant research called the Seattle Longitudinal Study that followed couples for up to 35 years. And they found that couples over time became more similar in their vocabulary, intelligence, and happiness. So who you choose will change who you become over time. And that's really important, you know, and it's something that philosophers have talked about. You know, Aristotle said, goodness is hard, it's easier if you're with someone good. He wasn't talking about romantic relationships, but the principle remains, you know, if you're trying to be a kind person and you're trying to live in accordance with a number of values, it's going to be really hard if you've committed to someone who doesn't share any of those values.
Yeah. What about if you're not completely committed? Is monogamy natural? Why do people cheat on their partners?
I have to say, I became a bit obsessed by this question. Unfortunately, I don't think that monogamy is natural, or at least it's not universal, whether that's in the animal kingdom or in humans. So, I mean, the vast, vast majority of animals are not monogamous. And of those that we thought were, like swans, DNA testing shows now that in any given clutch of eggs, up to 40% are fathered by a different male. So many scientists believe that the bonobo is our closest living relative and they have sex all the time. So in the animal kingdom, it's not looking good. And then in humans, it doesn't look great either. So when the OECD did a review of 160 countries, which is most of the countries in the world, 46% accepted marriage to more than one person, in whole or in part. And then you've got the remaining countries where monogamy is supposedly the norm, and infidelity rates are incredibly high, up to 72% for men, 70% for women. And then you've got 21% of people, according to a large US study, who are trying out non-monogamy. So exactly who is being monogamous? And I'm not saying that monogamy is bad or worthless or we shouldn't bother. I'm just saying I don't think it's easy. And this kind of shame and secrecy about infidelity and non-monogamy overlooks that it's difficult.
And do you think that because we live longer, we might be moving into a new age where serial monogamy is acceptable? So you're with someone for, you know, 7-10 years, and then you move on, and that becomes the natural way. Perhaps one person to have your children with and another person to bring them up with.
Yes, that is interesting. Well, we've seen a trend in the last 40 years across countries around the world where marriage has declined and divorce has increased. So I think that you're right in what you're saying. But I also think that in that situation, if you're considering children, you know, if attachment theory is right, then it's the ideal is that children have a sense of security and stability. And divorce and breakups, the research is pretty clear on this. It's not great for them. There are things you can do to minimize the harm, like not dragging them into arguments, for example, not remarrying or getting into another relationship incredibly quickly, only to realize that that wasn't right either, because the number of transitions really impacts a child's well-being. So I think that there is a, you know, if you're thinking from the child's point of view, there's an argument in favor of kind of a long-term commitment, I think. But, you know, beyond that, I think I'm not surprised that people are practicing serial monogamy. And I'm also not surprised that people are cheating.
Because?
So I think a lot of people don't know why they cheat. There's a lot of subconscious things at play there. But there's a few research studies that I found very interesting where they asked people why they cheated. And they gave reasons like conquest and power, fun, career advancement, exploring sexual identity. But you're relying on people being aware of why they cheat, and they don't always know. And another thing I think that's important to say about cheating is Shirley Glass, who was a very, very brilliant infidelity researcher, found there was a lot of research where people in happy or very happy relationships admitted to cheating was something like 50-something% in men and 30-something% in women, I think. And they said, yeah, we were really happy and we cheated. I think it's easy to think that infidelity only happens in unhappy relationships, and that's not the case.
When you're in an unhappy relationship, how do you know that it's time to call time? Why and when should you walk away?
So there's some fascinating research on this. There are a number of very large studies that happen nationwide, and then researchers get access to that evidence and run their own tests on it. And this happened in the US, and they looked at thousands of people who were married over and then broke up over a 4 to 7 year period. And they found that of the people that decided to break up, half were much happier 7 years, 4 to 7 years later, and half were significantly less happy. And when they looked at the underlying data and all the factors, they decided that the reason that half were less happy was that actually that half, they scored average on all measures of happiness in the relationship, but they demonstrated risk factors associated with divorce, with like a higher likelihood of divorce. For example, having parents that divorced themselves, having quite relaxed attitudes to divorce, having got married very, very young, having stepchildren in the family, having lived together before getting married. So that half, the researchers concluded that essentially they ended quite a good relationship and regretted it. The other half, they were in highly dysfunctional, abusive relationships, and when they left, they were much happier. So I think the first thing to say is, if you're in a highly abusive or dysfunctional relationship, and that's not always easy to recognise because the research is clear on this, a lot of people do not use the word abuse when they could or should. So, you know, particularly with emotional abuse, but even with physical, because people will be physically abusive and then promise never to do it again. So it's very easy to not see it for what it is. But if you're in that kind of relationship, then it is best to leave as soon as you can. But again, that's not that straightforward because it's difficult to leave in a safe way. So you need support. But if you're in a generally happy relationship, then it is really important, I think, to explore whether the desire to leave is coming from a subconscious desire to avoid commitment or from something in your upbringing or your past that is making you want to run away from this, or an unrealistic expectation, because relationships do lose their excitement. You know, we find novelty attractive. There's so much research on this, you know. So if you think, oh, I don't want to, you know, jump into bed with this person, so therefore that means the relationship is doomed. Well, no, because the research suggests that that's kind of what most relationships become. But also there are things you can do to change that, you know, that you have to have a growth mindset essentially in respect to relationships and passion. I also think it's worth looking at what philosophers say about this, because they talk about, I think the basis of long-term relationships is friendship. And I think it's worth exploring whether the relationship you have is one where the other person has your best interests at heart, and whether you share values and whether you trust them. I think they're really important questions. I think it comes largely down to friendship.
The book is structured so that each chapter begins with a personal story from an interviewee, which is deeply fascinating. I think we all like to get a look into the lives of others. And I wonder what your own story is, if love, studying love, has changed your opinion, and if you are in a partnership, and if that changed at all during the course of writing this book.
I broke up with the man that I'm now married to. And when I was going through the whole hit by a car misery, he was really lovely and supportive, and I pushed him away. And I think I had avoidant tendencies. It's really hard to go back and know without without going back in time and doing some measurements. I don't think we can ever be sure, but we can make up stories about ourselves. I think I had avoidant tendencies, and I had a tendency to break up with everyone. I had a tendency to find flaws in the people that I dated. And I think I had unrealistic expectations. And I think that was all a response to losing a parent figure as a child. I came to learn that love meant losing the people you love. And I think, you know, I'm not alone. You know, if the research is right, 23% of the population are avoidant. The language on this is a bit sticky, because depending on the researchers, you can either be avoidant or not, or you could be somewhere on a scale. So it's a bit sticky. I then wrote this book and had all this health misery. And it's been invaluable. And I don't think I'd be married had I not done it. And now it's just, you know, when my husband proposed, I had a very visceral reaction. I was not joyful. I felt very, like, anxious. And the commitment felt, you know, so overwhelming. And I was able to say to him, we were in Australia at the time, so we were pretty isolated. But I was able to say, I'm really sorry. This is not what you would hope for in someone that you've proposed to, but it's not about you. This is my avoidant attachment pattern, having a bit of a freak out. And then it calmed down, and now we've been together for 5 years. Well, we've been together for like 10 or 15, but married for five. And we're able to talk about it. You know, if I'm having a moment where I need a bit of space, we both understand it a bit more. But it's also a bit annoying because sometimes he'll go, Laura, you're being avoidant. And I'll go, don't throw my book back at me. But yeah, it's been really, really helpful, really helpful. And also helpful as a parent, because we're parents and I'm really conscious of trying to be the best kind of secure parent I can be for my son.
I think it's going to be really, really helpful to all of your readers too. Laura, thank you very much indeed. That's We Need to Talk About Love by Laura Mooker. It's published by Bloomsbury. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.